Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to issue 156 of the Bugle, the world's foremost and only audio newspaper for a visual world for the week beginning Monday, the 6th of June, 2011. I am Andy Zaltzman, and I'm in London. And if you don't believe me, listen to this. The unmistakable sound of the London purple-plumed yowking bird sleeping. And joining me from New York City, USB. No, it's just been promoted again. USA, right back where it belongs. It's the man who could have been the face of the QVC shopping channel if he'd have been someone else. It's John Oliver.
Hello, Andy. Hello, Buglers. Andy and Buglers, I am beyond tired. I only just made it to New York, Andy, whatever time it was last night, because, well, basically, I crossed the city limits of Knackersville sometime yesterday, seemed to black out, and woke up in totally f***ing town. What happened?
Yeah, but the police can't chase you there, can they, once you're over the border?
They don't have jurisdiction there. What happened was, Andy, I spent the last 2 days chasing Sarah Palin on her impromptu, heavily planned family holiday slash campaign tour. I was Tailin Palin, as my 2-day autobiography will lazily be called. Now, we'd hoped just to shoot very briefly with the whole media circus in New York on Wednesday morning, but in order to get anything half decent, we ended up having to follow the convoy of journalists and hangers-on all the way up to New Hampshire. It was like a very, very depressing cannonball run, but without a bird-flipping orangutan to keep everyone's spirits up. It was both incredible and soul-crushing, Andy, to witness the journalists feel like they had to chase her down like political paparazzi. It was the worst of nature in action, a great migration of pointlessness across 5 state lines. It would have been enough to have David Attenborough campaigning for the forced extinction of humanity.
In that time, John, did you see her kill a moose?
I didn't see her kill a moose, but I'm pretty sure I heard her kill a moose from inside the bus. I definitely saw a moose being pushed unwillingly onto the bus, and I heard a scuffling sound and then a loud bang.
Right.
And then I heard what sounded like Sarah Palin scream, "F*** yeah!"
So do you think now you probably know how to kill and skin a moose, learned it by osmosis, just by being close?
Yeah, if I can match the sounds, then I think I'm going to end up with a dead moose around my feet.
Because she osmoses knowledge, Sarah Palin. That's one of the great things about her.
She does. It's certainly one of the great things about her. I think what's now become clear, Andy, is that Sarah Palin has become an addiction for the press that they cannot kick. They know it's bad for them and for everyone around them. But when you get that itch, sometimes the sole answer is the emotional crack that only Sarah Palin can provide. It was like the press were all a bunch of Captain Ahabs chasing down their white whale. If, in Moby Dick, Captain Ahab had actually hated the whale deep down and was being forced to chase it by his supervisor. And I actually spoke briefly with SP, Andy, and I think our conversation probably went exactly as well as both of us thought it might. It started strained and then steadily declined from there. I guess until we'd looked into each other's eyes, there was still a hypothetical chance that if eye contact ever one day happened, we'd instantly fall in love and one of us would abandon every principle we held dear and embrace the other's views completely. I guess at least now we know that that has not happened. It'll probably be easier for each of us to go forward with our lives separately right now, safe in the knowledge that what relationship we have is built on a rock-solid foundation of deep mutual contempt.
Yeah, but that's always the way it starts in films, isn't it, John? And
true.
Then, you know, give it an hour and a half.
True.
You'll be riding off into the sunset on a donkey.
The friction has begun. Stand aside, Todd. I will have my woman.
But there was a picture on the Daily Mail website over here, John, and because I was just trying to read up about Palin's trip. Mm-hmm. And I scrolled down and there was a picture of Palin with the caption, "Attention grabber, Sarah Palin has grabbed media attention wherever her One Nation bus tour has landed." Mm-hmm. And the picture was Palin having a microphone thrust at her by young cub reporter John Oliver.
Oh, God.
There was a look in her eye, unmistakably said, "I don't trust you." A look in her eye that almost suggested, even, John, that she was at that Edinburgh preview gig we did at the Picture House in York.
That was the last time I saw that expression so fervently placed across one human face. The fact, Andy, that that picture was in the Daily Mail has made the last 2 days even more depressing than they were, which was f***ing depressing.
Well, that bus was quite impressive, wasn't it, for just a quiet family holiday? It was,
Well, it was, but every family, Andy, every summer, likes to laden themselves into a massive flag-draped bus and sign the side of it with a gigantic autograph. Your family did it, my family did it.
I did it last year when we went to Italy. We had a great big bus and a slogan on the back saying, "Find me some pasta and put it in my face." But slightly different to slogan, Palin's slogan, which was "Join the fundamental restoration of America."
Yes.
Which doesn't make a great deal of obvious sense, other than the fact that the word "fundament," of course, is an archaic term for arsehole. So maybe that's the subliminal text. And the main picture on the bus was of, I think, mountains in Alaska, with absolutely no people anywhere to be seen, a view that basically hasn't changed for millions of years. And I think that is the ultimate Palin vision. Well, America as it used to be before people ruined it.
And that's where her signature was placed as well, over the mountains. I think that might be her Alaskan Mount Rushmore now, just her signature scrawled, carved across the mountains.
She's been at various historical sites on the tour. She visited the National Archives in Washington, D.C., where she had a look at historic documents from U.S. history, such as the Declaration of Independence, the lesser-known but equally influential Declaration of Awesomeness, and the first surprisingly blue draft of Star Spangled Banner, plus Benjamin Franklin's recipe for chili con carne, which possibly explains his nickname of Benny Lubrake, and Abraham Lincoln's fire from the Balco Laboratory. And I'm sorry, Lincoln fans, but it turns out he was definitely juicing. There's absolutely no way a man, however tall, can run the 100 metres in under 10 seconds wearing a stovepipe hat. Absolutely. Just aerodynamically, it doesn't add up. Which, of course, means the result of the Civil War has been annulled, and the war will be refought, but this time with paintballs due to modern health and safety regulations. So, busy week. Busy week for Palin.
Busy week.
Of course, I guess you could say Palin is basically America's Pippa Middleton.
You could say that, although my feelings tend to be the polar opposite.
Incidentally, it was announced just this morning that on the £10 note, the face of Charles Darwin is going to be replaced with the arse of Pippa Middleton.
Good idea. Yep. Good idea. Pippa, welcome to my wallet.
Anyway, that was quite a long preamble.
Yes.
So, this is Bugle 156, John. Which means that we've now done one bugle for each resident at the time of the 2000 census of the village of Elk River, Idaho. And I would say that the planet ain't big enough for the two of us, John.
Yeah.
There's only room for one thing related to the number 156, so it's with a heavy heart but a sense of duty that on behalf of the bugle, I declare war on the village of Elk River, Idaho. Now, I think tactically the key, John, is to strike fast. They're a small village in Idaho. They won't be expecting a military onslaught.
Right.
So we probably want to hit their navy first. They've got a big reservoir nearby before we send in the ground troops. That's you, Ped, and Chris. Slash and burn tactics is the go-to, I reckon. Chris has done triathlon, so he can swim across the reservoir, cycle into town, and then run around in his underpants confusing people until you've knocked out the Elk River Lodge and General Store. That's going to be crucial to our hopes of eradicating Elk River as a going concern. So, and also, it's famous for its proximity to America's largest tree, so I reckon we take that tree hostage and threaten to turn it into kitchen roll unless our demands are met. We've got to break them psychologically. And any buglers in Elk River wishing to sue for peace, please email in your surrender to thebugle@timesonline.co.uk and mark the subject box, "All Hell Buglords, Merciless Masters of All."
We may not accept that, but we will consider it. Top story this week! Andy, I don't know what the top story is. I'm woefully underprepared for this bugle.
It's the coffee getting you through it, John. That's,
well, the coffee is keeping me awake,
right?
But it's not really affecting anything beyond my eyelids.
All right, okay. Well, I guess, I mean, we could. Have you been watching the Mladic trial?
No, Andy, I've been watching the back of a bus disappearing in the distance.
Did you not ask Palin who what her money was on for the Mladic trial?
I didn't. I should have.
I do have the latest odds for the Mladic trial. Not guilty has drifted slightly to 250-1. Guilty is 2-1. Unmasked as Tom Hanks, 6-1. Broken out as a prank on a TV game show, 10-1. And pulls a fatal sickie is 6-1 on favourite. It's always your go-to option in that circumstance, isn't it? He's already said he's a dangerously sick man. But anyway, the other top story this week is old people saving the world. A group of 200 Japanese pensioners have volunteered to tackle the ongoing crisis at the Fukushima nuclear power station. They have claimed that they, being old and nearly dead, should be facing the dangers of radiation, not young people. This is, John...
Wow.
This is an inspiring story.
That is one of those stories, Andy, that instantly makes you feel like a selfish piece of shit.
Yeah, but I'm a selfish piece of shit in my mid-30s, so that's entirely justified.
Okay.
I could have done with these guys. It's led by the Skilled Veterans Corps, led by retired engineer Yasuteru Yamada, who is coming out of retirement like the Michael Jordan of nuclear power plants that he is, and bringing some of his old buddies with him. I could certainly have done with him. This man is clearly unafraid of death. I could have done with him... that gig I did at the Manchester Comedy Store all those years ago. This would have been nice if someone a bit older and less sensitive had taken that punishment. But he said, I'm 72, and on average, I probably have 13 to 15 years left to live. Even if I were exposed to radiation, cancer could take 20 or 30 years or longer to develop. Therefore, us older ones have less chance of getting cancer. That's pretty gung-ho, John. And this could be the start of something very, very special indeed. Let's hope these old people don't stop at nuclear power crises. We are facing... a pensions crisis around the world. Will Mr. Yamada's heroism inspire his fellow codgers and codgerettes to think, young people need my money more than I do. I'm going to do my bit for the world and smother myself with a pillow. I go so far as to say that all high-risk jobs, military, emergency services, catching sharks for aquariums, should be done by people very much on the down escalator of life with nothing much to live for, who would probably appreciate the opportunity to get out of their nursing homes and have a bit of excitement in their lives.
It really is an incredible gesture, Andy, but the problem is there must be other 70-year-old Japanese men saying, yeah, that sounds tremendous, Yasuteru, and the numbers certainly do look watertight, but you know what? I'm not f***ing going in there. And I don't want to explain why. I'm not f***ing going in there. For weeks now, apparently, Mr. Yamada has been getting back in touch with old friends, sending out emails and even messages on Twitter. And that's got to be a tough email to receive. Hey, Yasuteru, great to hear from you after all these years. You want me to what now? You want me to go with you into the radioactive Fukushima nuclear reactors? Sure. Or do you know what? We could just meet up for a coffee and catch up that way. I bet anyone who met him in life is now frantically either claiming that they're having trouble with their email or changing their addresses entirely and shutting down their Facebook pages.
Well, I want to know, John, where was this spirit in World War One? Why do we waste the flower of youth in the battle for control of some mud in France when old people would have been just as adept at walking slowly towards machine guns and being mown down out of their prime? Surely that would have been a much more efficient use of resources.
I was just reading now. He said that it was while Mr. Yamada was watching television news that he decided it was time for his generation to stand up. And some of the older members of his generation in Japan actually stood up before when they were much younger men. But the less said about that, the better, Andy. Look, he's volunteering to take the place of younger walkers. Workers, he said, is not brave, but logical. And that's exactly the kind of thing that a superhero would say. Oh, hold on, it says down here, he says he's laughed off suggestions that his proposed team is comparable to the kamikaze pilots who flew suicide missions in World War II, saying, we are not kamikaze. The kamikaze was something strange, no risk management there. They were going to die, but we're going to come back. We have to work, but never die. Andy, there's another key difference there as well, and one that I might have led with before that, and that is that they're not trying to kill anyone. In fact, they're literally trying to do the opposite.
And probably going in at a slightly lower velocity as well, I hope. Maybe he's just going to ride a Zimmer frame as hard as he can into the side of the reactor, try and finish it off. Economics news now, and a report has said that Britain's parks, lakes and forests are worth billions of pounds to the economy. The health benefits of just living close to some green space could be worth up to £300 per person per year.
But how much, Andy, would it be worth if you concreted over it and built stuff on it? Probably even more.
Well, this is the thing, John. And for a start, it is a sad thing for humanity that the only way we can now understand the value of the countryside is by putting a personal financial value on it.
Float it on the stock market. Let the market decide, Andy.
Yeah.
The countryside's value crashed down today.
But I never thought much about it, because, as you said, I always thought it would be much more useful if concrete over, better not just for the economy, but also for the environment, John, because there was a report a little while ago that said that it's actually more environmentally friendly to live in a city than in the countryside, where you have to drive more and drive further, use more heating and burn more witches. So the upshot of that is that we should concrete over the entire countryside for the good of the environment, which is one of the quirky anomalies that modern life throws up every now and again. But I want to know, how do they quantify this £300 a year of value? I mean, is it kind of spiritual value? I mean, what is the financial equivalent of the joy gained by seeing a squirrel eat a nut? I'd say a maximum of £1. I wouldn't. Maybe if it falls off a branch while trying to eat it, £1.50. The smell of freshly cut grass in the spring, £8.99, John. I'd say that is worth the same as a reasonable paperback book. A bit like John Grisham's latest Denzel Washington, Bulgar Slayer, a semi-fictional thriller based on the multi-award-winning actor's lost years as a gangster in Sofia. Or Cheryl Cole's somewhat unexpected journey into high-level scientific research, submolecular protein structures. And as for the gentle sound of Leather on Willow, the easy, relaxing rhythm of a cricket match, I'd say that's worth £90, John.
Wow.
And that is also what Lord's Cricket Ground thinks it's worth. That's what it's going to cost me to go and see a day's play of England against India in July. And watching a dog bark at a postman, chase that postman across the village green, corner him in a bus shelter and tear him limb from limb, howling with bloodlust, priceless. Just me on that one. Sorry, not postman, Nazi. Nazi, that's it. And not dog, but lawyer. So, there you go. I mean, it's so hard to put financial values on things. I love my wife, John.
Yeah.
I'd say she's worth a good £38 a day to me. That's how much I love her. Just hanging out with her is the equivalent of, to me, of going to the cinema, having a couple of pints in the pub, and then a takeaway pizza. That's really as much as a man can love a woman, isn't it?
You need to explain to her, Andy, that that's nicer than it sounds. And you need to put it better than that.
Oh, we've been married nearly 7 years, John. Yeah, I think she knows where we stand. Now, on current form, I've got about 3 weeks before she gets around to listening to this bugle. So I'm going to have to make some contingency plans.
Swearing news now. And Victoria Police in Australia, and they are set to start fining people for swearing in public in order to combat antisocial behaviour. If caught, you could be fined up to $240 Australian. Now, that is a terrifying potential law, Andy, especially for people like you and me. The Bugle, for instance, would instantly become financially unsustainable. Also, this law needs to be very carefully written, because there have got to be some times when the law allows for mitigating circumstances. For instance, when something falls on your foot, when you hit your thumb with a hammer, when a sports team you support scores a goal, when a sports team you support concedes a goal, when Donald Trump appears on the television, when Sarah Palin is unexpectedly standing right in front of you talking into your microphone, if you're an international terrorist and an elite team of Navy SEALs burst through your door, when FIFA president Sepp Blatter rings on your doorbell and asks if he can borrow a cup of sugar, when Pippa Middleton does anything, and when Pippa Middleton does nothing.
But, I mean, it's amazing that this scheme is starting off in Australia, John. That is, in effect, banning Australians from talking to all practical purposes.
That's true. That's the key problem. The Australians, to put it mildly, know their way around a swear word. They love swearing as much as they love drink driving, but slightly less than they love doing those two things together. They don't stand a chance with a law like this, which is why, Andy, it's now important that a major charity comes forward and starts organising an appeal for the now vulnerable swearers of Australia. One of the planet's most colourful and flamboyant species is under threat like never before. The sweary Australian has been a fixture of the Southern Hemisphere for centuries and contributes to its delicate eco-balance. Yet now, the very real threat looms over us, that your children may never hear the sweary Australian's natural cries of f**k, shitbags, bloody hell, and f**karoo. They may never hear them in the wild again. Just don't let these creatures become something we go to see for entertainment in zoos. Sponsor an Australian today. Just $10 a month can enable a wicket keeper to engage in some light sledging with the mid-order batsman in front of him. Just $20 a month can help a man who has just been attacked by a wombat respond appropriately. And a donation of $50 a month would pay for an Australian with a loudhailer to scale Ayers Rock every morning and scream, F***aroo! At his entire nation, like a foul-mouthed alarm clock.
Well, count me in, John. Count me in. I'm setting up a standing order for those people. Oh, former producer Tom's out there. He's barely able to open his mouth anymore.
Let the man swear.
But it's not just Australia, John. A similar scheme is being launched in Barnsley in Yorkshire.
Oh, come on.
Where swearing could cost you £80 a word. And these are dark days for humanity, John. I did a gig in Barnsley last weekend. And let me tell you, when I heard the sales figures, I was £160 down straight away.
That's true. That is true, Andy. It's not really an £80 fine, is it? Because if you ever issue an £80 fine, it very quickly becomes a £160 fine. Shit! Oh, what's that, officer? What, seriously? You're f***ing joking, aren't you? What? How much now? Shit! Oh, God, I'll get my f***ing wallet. Obviously, having said all this, it is clearly a great potential revenue source for the government. And with the way many economies are now, it could be a fiscal life support to have a national swear jar. Now, can the Irish and the Greeks now swear their way out of trouble? Can the Portuguese bullshit their way out of bankruptcy? But I guess the key question is, Andy, regarding the last story, what are British people more willing to give up, their entire countryside or their right to swear freely? I think deep down, we all know the answer to that.
I mean, for a start, John, I mean, this is clearly a tax on people with f***ing limited f***ing vocabularies, which in my book is f***ing un-f***ing fair. But there's also a freedom of speech issue here. We fought two world wars for the freedom to swear in public in English. In fact, we have a civic duty to swear as much as humanly possible in English. Otherwise, we might as well have let the Nazis win.
Tough week to be on the bleeper, Ped. Tough week to come off the bench.
Bunch of
Well, you just gave yourself two there, and one of those was a big one. This is a distinctly un-American move by the Australians, Andy. America, you know, the country I'm sitting on right now, is built on freedom of speech, and the founding fathers themselves all had terrible potty mouths. In fact, the first draft of the Constitution read, "We, the f***ing people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defence, promote the general welfare and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and to our posterity, to ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America." Shit yeah!
Bugle feature section now, and it's a quiz. And this is a quiz that sprung from a Twitter message sent to me by someone called Garster P on Twitter, alerting me to something that he thought we might be interested in, John. And it's okay. Led to this quiz question.
Okay.
And the question is, and see if you can get this right, there is a prize at the end.
That's good.
Okay. Who or what is a cockchafer? Now, is a cockchafer...
Yes.
A, a German pole vaulter. Mikhail Cockchafer finished fourth in the 1984 Olympic final. And his legions of adoring fans in the stands would celebrate his successful jumps by whipping out an inflatable cockerel, then rubbing it against an abrasive surface until it popped.
Okay, that sounds plausible.
Okay. Was it B, a ship, HMS Cockchafer, to be precise?
I mean, already, Andy, I'm liking the authenticity of this by the fact that you're laughing through the start of the explanation.
A First World War gunboat, HMS Cockchafer, launched in 1915. There's some dispute over why it was so named. Some say it was in honour of the recently deceased former King Edward VII's sexually transmitted diseases. Others say it was named after the hymn tune Cockchafer that was widely used to accompany the Lord's My Shepherd before the less controversial Crimond became popular. And others that when it was launched in 1915, the then First Lord of the Admiralty, Arthur Balfour, the former Prime Minister, picked up the traditional bottle of champagne that he was about to hurl onto the ship, and as he was saying, "I name this ship HMS," dropped it on his foot and expleted, "Ah, Cockchafer!" Then in an effort to save face, styled it out, saying, "Yep, you heard me, HMS Cockchafer." Next up, HMS Borlake. So, A, a pole vaulter, B, a ship.
Yeah.
C, a cockchafer is an insect.
Hmm.
Described as being knob-shaped at the end, also known as a spang beetle.
Right.
A cockchafer is widely considered, in agricultural circles at least, to be a real cock, eating crops and stuff. Real cockish behaviour. To such an extent that in 14th century France, some cockchafers were put on trial and convicted. And then sentenced to clear off within 3 days. When they failed to abide by the terms of their sentence, they were rounded up and killed. The cockchafer was also considered by some to be quite tasty. Whack a load of cockchafers in some nice hot butter, cook them up with some stock and liver, and you got yourself a cockchafingly tasty snack. And in fact, the ace inventor, Nikola Tesla, claimed his first invention was a cockchafer-driven engine.
Oh, okay.
No one knows exactly why the cockchafer is called a cockchafer. It might be because it has something to do with the fact that if you affix a cockchafer to your strangle tube, it will, in all likelihood, in its attempts to escape, chafe. So that's option C. Option D, cockchafer, was a thrash metal band formed and fronted by Cliff Richard. So Cliff, in his attempts to appeal to an edgier audience, launched cockchafer in 1996 after his performance singing during a rainbreak at Wimbledon brought him back into the public eye, alongside top tennis stars Conchita Martinez and Gigi Fernandez, who'd both sung backing vocals at Wimbledon. Richard recruited former Anthrax and Stormtroopers of Death guitarist Dan Lilker, as well as Lee Reynolds, the drummer from Wisconsin Thrasher's Morbid Saint, and of course his old Shadows compadre Hank Marvin, who was initially unconvinced by Cliff's new thrash metal direction, but later embraced it wholly and formed the influential doom metal combo Beelzebub Shitstorm and the Eyeballs of Pain. Anyway, Cockchafer released 3 singles, I Want My Egyptian Brain Spike, The Genital Janitor, and Dying Doll, a cover of Cliff's own Living Doll smash hit, but broke up after one of them notoriously violent live shows, ended up with Cliff Richard setting former Wimbledon champion Conchita Martinez on fire and serving her out of a catapult into the crowd. Martinez tweaked an ankle ligament on landing, ruling her out of the 1997 French Open Championships. She decided to concentrate on her tennis, and after a brief period in which former world number one and two-time Wimbledon champion Yvonne Goolagong replaced Martinez, Cockchafer disbanded in a hail of recriminations, as Richard accused Lilker of going soft and Reynolds of being obsessed with doing Helen Shapiro covers. He also said that Hank Marvin was now unable to function without 2 pounds of raw meat on stage and a live eel in his trousers. A partial reconciliation resulted in Ilker and his former Anthrax colleague Scott Ian writing the music and lyrics for Cliff Richard's 1999 number one hit, The Millennium Prayer. So is it A, B, C, or D?
Andy, I mean, it's a long question. And I'm going to go with a short answer. I think it's the insect, Andy, C.
Right, well, it's a trick question, actually, because there are 2 correct answers.
Oh, wow. Did I get one of them?
You did get one of them. That is right, it is an insect.
Oh, that's good.
The cockchafer. So was it a thrash metal band?
Thrash metal.
A pole vaulter or HMS Cockchafer?
I'm so badly wanted to be HMS Cockchafer, Andy. In fact, I'm going to go HMS Cockchafer.
Cockchafer. You've got it right, John.
Oh, my God.
And not only was that was the fifth.
What?
It was the fifth HMS Cockchafer.
He dropped it on his foot 5 times. Yep, that's right. Yeah, the fourth one. Yep. Yeah, we're still naming him that. Ow!
Yep, HMS Cockchafer and the Cockchafer Beetle. So there you go. And if you've got the answers right, Buglers, then you've won today's star prize, which is the opportunity to have a private reunion gig by Cockchafer live in your living room, subject to Cliff Richard being available and still alive, and which I think he is for now, and also to Martinez and Fernandez not being tied up playing on the Veterans Tennis Circuit. What a name. HMS Cockchafer. Your emails now, and this comes on the subject of For Your Cruising Pleasure from Ruddick, who writes, Dear John, Chris and Andy, the badonkadonk is in fact real. So this is the badonkadonk tank that we alerted you to last week.
Yeah.
And has been causing mischief and mayhem with the Leyland Stanford Junior University marching band for the better part of a decade. The donk's creator is a member of the band and has made a number of upgrades, mostly pyrotechnic in nature.
I'm looking at it now. Oh, my God.
I'll post these pictures on Twitter.
A lot of fire coming off the donk.
There's even a remote-controlled miniature, the Badinkadink.
I can see it, too.
I'm sure if you were ever in the Stanford area and wanted to rock out with a band, you could get a ride on the donk. So there we go.
Wow.
But even more excitingly than that, John...
Oh, that's phenomenal.
...is that Graham Trudeau, bugler and regular correspondent, has taken it upon himself to contact the manufacturer of the badonkadonk, who replied, Hello, thanks for your interest in the badonkadonk. Pricing for the base model, with no pyro but including all the lighting and sound mentioned on the site, is $20,000.
Yeah.
But can vary widely depending on the options selected.
Yes.
Production time is approximately 3 months right now.
Okay.
So, I mean, this is starting to look like a potential wedding present, John.
Yeah. A wedding present, and let's call it an early divorce present as well. If you need me, I will be in the donk.
For shipping, I've never shipped one of these, so I'm not really sure what range of price that might be. But I'm also, this is slightly concerning, currently talking to a potential client in the UK who thinks it wouldn't be more than £5,000.
Oh, my God.
Oh. New York is a long way, but it would probably be much less than that, maybe around $3,000 to ship it to New York.
Oh, God.
So that's from the heroic manufacturer of the badonkadonk. So that's all we got to raise, buglers. $20,000 plus delivery.
And the donk can be ours. At which point we are going after that f***ing village you mentioned before, Andy.
The Bugle on tour. Flames of fury. And this one comes in from Daff in Stoke Newington, who writes on the subject, Bin Laden's chicken motorcycle team. And he writes, Dear John, Andy and Chris, I appreciate I'm a little late to the party here, but the fact uncovered exclusively by the Bugle that Osama bin Laden was trying to train 150 chickens to become a motorcycle display team is telling. As 150 is not a triangular or a pyramid number, they could not successfully combine to form either of those shapes while perched atop their tiny scooters.
Yeah.
The best he could hope for is an unevenly stepped chicken motorcycle ziggurat. I think this lack of planning and foresight goes somewhat to explaining why Al-Qaeda are no longer the force they once were.
Good point.
Yeah. Ratko Mladic, 45 turkeys. And he's split them into 3 rugby teams.
God, he was living the life of Riley, Andy. Release the ball, turkey. Release the ball. Number 3. Get out of there. Right, captains.
No beaks in eyes. That's a straight red card offence. On your feet. On your feet. So do keep your emails coming in to thebugle@timesandline.co.uk. And if you've got any contributions to the Bugle Badonkadonk Fund, Just pop them through my letterbox.
Yeah. Cash only.
Oh, the appeal for my children's heroic running race obstacle course has raised nearly £2,000. You can still
great.
Give to it.
That's great. Thank you very much, Buglers.
Justgiving.co.uk/hellobuglers. So we're still some way short of the 700 million I was trying to raise, but...
You got a tenth of a badonkadonk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good word.
That, that is a very good word. I don't know what you get for that. Maybe a turret. So thanks very much to all of those who've given so far. Sport now, and well, sport has been dominated this week by football. Two things, one good, one bad. One, the aftermath of the Barcelona absolutely humping Manchester United in the Champions League final. John, what was the reaction in America to this fantastic display of European dominance?
Well, I think it was a useful... I think it was a useful way of saying, if Americans watch that game and still don't like football, then I will accept they're never going to like it. Because that's about as good as it can possibly get. God, they were amazing, Barcelona, Andy. They were amazing. The referee should have paid for a ticket. He should have been charged afterwards saying, that's £120. You had an amazing seat to watch that.
It was kind of like watching Michelangelo paint the Sistine Chapel while Mozart was tinkling the ivories down below him.
Yeah, exactly.
But the bad side has been FIFA shenanigans and Sepp Blatter being re-elected unopposed amidst a storm of accusations of corruption and sackings of his rivals. And there is a kind of aura about Sepp Blatter, John, that's the head of FIFA, that suggests that the people of Rome were very lucky that he wasn't born 2,000 years earlier.
That is true.
And he would have made the Emperor Nero look like Joe Biden. But the surprise with Blatter's, he was re-elected, John. And the surprise was how badly he did in this re-election. He only got 186 out of 203 possible votes. And you would have thought a leader like him would have got at least 220 of those votes.
Absolutely. He's losing it.
He's got a lot to learn from some of the masters. So that's it for this week's Bugle. The Bugle forecast, to conclude the audio newspaper, is by this time next week, will John and Sarah Palin's romance have taken the tentative first steps towards the inevitable ultimate consummation?
Well, who knows? Who knows, Andy?
Well, it's got all the classic hallmarks. I mean, it's basically like Groundhog Day, but more so, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we're still in that stage where Andy McDowell hates me, Andy. I haven't worked out how to win around yet.
Well, basically, between now and election time, you'll have countless opportunities.
Yeah, I just need to have another 80 attempts at that first conversation between the two of us going better.
Thank you for listening, Buglers. We'll be back again next week. Goodbye.
Farewell!